and you are likely familiar with the frustration of someone else twisting logic, cherry-picking, or distorting facts, and being generally biased in their defense of a position. Of course, here's the thing. You do it too. Psychological studies have shown that people treat different beliefs differently. For most beliefs, people are actually mostly rational at baseline. We tend to follow a Bayesian approach, meaning that we update our beliefs as new information comes to our attention. If we are told that some historical fact is different than what we remember, we'll quickly change our beliefs about that historical fact. Further, the more information we have about something, and therefore the more solid our belief, the more slowly we will change that belief. We don't just change from one thing to the next. We incorporate the new information with our old information. This is actually a very scientific approach. I would not easily change my belief that the sun is roughly at the center of our solar system. It would take a profound amount of very reliable information to counter all the solid scientific information on which my current belief is based. If, however, I was told by a reliable source something about George Washington I'd never heard before, I would accept it much more quickly. This is reasonable, and this is how most people function day to day. I describe this process as mostly rational because even at our best, people have cognitive biases and follow heuristics, or mental shortcuts, see chapter 11, that are not strictly valid. These biases constrain our reason. The constraint on reason, though, is far greater when dealing with the special set of beliefs in which we have an emotional investment. These are alleged facts or beliefs about the world that support our sense of identity or our ideology. They may be part of our worldview. Skeptics commonly call such beliefs sacred cows. We all have narratives by which we understand the world and our place in it. Some narratives are critical to our sense of identity. Preferred narratives support our worldview, our membership in a group, or our self-perception as a good and valuable person. We have narratives and beliefs that serve our basic psychological needs, such as the need for a sense of control. When those beliefs are challenged, we don't take a rational and detached approach. We dig in our heels and engage in what is called motivated reasoning. We defend the core beliefs at all costs, shredding logic, discarding inconvenient facts, making up facts as necessary, cherry-picking only the facts we like, engaging in magical thinking, and using subjective judgments as necessary without any consideration for internal consistency. Collectively, these processes constitute motivated reasoning, something at which humans generally excel. Motivated reasoning is triggered by what psychologists call cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance theory was first proposed by Leon Festinger in 1957. He suggested that psychological discomfort results when we are presented with two pieces of information that conflict with each other. We hold a belief, and now we have information that contradicts that belief. Ideally, we would resolve the conflict rationally and objectively, changing the belief as necessary, depending on the nature and validity of the new information. When the belief is strongly and emotionally held, however, it becomes too difficult to change. If the belief is at the core of our worldview, then changing it might cause a chain reaction, magnifying cognitive dissonance. It's emotionally easier to simply dismiss the new information, challenge its source, rationalize its implications, even invent a conspiracy to explain it. In fact, for common beliefs, motivated reasoning may come prepackaged for you. There are organized movements with itemized lists of rationalizations and misinformation that conveniently dismiss the evidence for evolution, global warming, vaccine effectiveness, the gender pay gap, the safety of genetically modified organisms, even the sphericity of the Earth. They are like a salve for cognitive dissonance. Just apply liberally. Motivated reasoning is further facilitated by the fact that much of our information is subjective or requires some judgment. No scientific study is perfect, so you can always point to limitations if you want to deny the conclusions. No source is impeccable, and people make mistakes, so perhaps this is one. different sources say different things, so you can choose to believe the one that reduces your cognitive dissonance. There are also numerous ways to interpret the implications of facts, even if the facts themselves are not in dispute. If someone is rich, then you can conclude, if you like them, that they are successful and savvy, or, if you don't like them, that they are corrupt and greedy. Someone can be either courageous or foolish, steadfast or stubborn, a strong leader or authoritarian. It all depends on your perspective. In general, political opinions tend to fall into the, quote, sacred cow category. People tend to identify with their political tribe and want to believe that their tribe is virtuous and smart, while the other tribe is mostly made of lying idiots. Of course, these dichotomies occur on a spectrum. You can have a little bit of an emotional attachment to a belief, or it can be fundamental to your worldview and identity. You can be a little tribal in your political views, or hyper-partisan. The neuroscience of motivated reasoning. Much of the psychological research on motivated reasoning involves political opinions. What multiple studies have shown is that people pursue two distinct goals when forming political opinions: a directional goal and an accuracy goal. The directional goal leads them to the opinion that is consistent with their partisan identity. The accuracy goal leads them to try to make their opinion as correct as possible. What researchers have found is that the more partisan the individual and the issue they are evaluating, the more directional their reasoning will be. They will weigh evidence more heavily if it supports their partisan identity. They will dismiss evidence that is against the party line. Individuals are easily primed, affected subconsciously by a stimulus as well. If they're told that a bill is sponsored by their party, they are far more likely to think it's a good idea and endorse it than if they think the identical bill was sponsored by the opposing party. Psychologists speak of this phenomenon as if describing a computer program. People will try to adjust their beliefs to simultaneously maximize the alignment of those beliefs with facts and maximize their emotional comfort. It's almost like a mathematical equation. The greater the emotional discomfort, cognitive dissonance, a fact presents, the harder we will work to rationalize it away. Perhaps the seminal study of this phenomenon is from 2010, in which Brendan Nehan and Jason Riefler purport to show a backfire effect. When confronted with information that contradicts a political opinion, subjects increase their belief in the misinformation. They specifically studied the claim that there were weapons of mass destruction, WMDs, in Iraq. However, a 2016 follow-up study by Thomas Wood and Ethan Porter found that the backfire effect was rare, occurring in only one question out of 36, the claim about WMDs. Even then, the effect depended on how the information was presented. The backfire effect clearly requires more research. When is it triggered and how long does the effect last? Partisans might accept the correction in the short term and then revert to their prior views over time. But these results support the notion that there is a conflict between the directional and accuracy goals. Neuroscientists have started looking at what's happening in the brain when subjects are confronted with facts that present a problem for their political beliefs, and when they're offered justifications that help to resolve the problem. Drew Weston et al. Used functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, which images brain activity, while challenging subjects with neutral information and information problematic for their political affiliation. They found that subjects used different parts of their brains in these two situations. When confronted with ideologically neutral information, subjects used the rational cognitive part of their brain. When confronted with partisan information, a completely different part lit up, one known to be associated with identity, sympathy, and emotion. Also interesting, after subjects arrived at their motivated conclusion, relieving the negative emotions of the conflict, the part of their brain involved in reward became activated, giving them a nice shot of dopamine. Motivated reasoning is a double whammy. It reduces the negative emotion of facts conflicting with our identity or beliefs, and it induces positive emotions associated with reward. This process can have a powerful conditioning effect, reinforcing the behavior. A 2016 study by Jonas Kaplan, Sarah Gimbel, and Sam Harris adds a bit of confirmation to this basic understanding. 40 left-leaning subjects had their brains scanned while being presented with statements that were designed to be either political or non-political. They were then confronted with counterclaims to contradict those facts, some of which were exaggerated or untrue. One example of a political claim used is that the U.S. spends too much of its resources on the military. The counterclaim is that Russia's nuclear arsenal is twice the size of the U.S.'s, which isn't true. Russia has 7,300 warheads to our 7,100. An example of a non-political claim is Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. One counter to that claim is that nearly 70 years before Edison, Humphrey Davy demonstrated an electric lamp to the Royal Society. This is true, but an exaggeration in that Davy's incandescent bulb was not practical. Edison's wasn't the first light bulb, but it was one of the first ones with the properties necessary to make its wide use feasible. Actually, English inventor Joseph Swan beat Edison to the practical light bulb and won a patent infringement case against Edison. The researchers looked at the activity in the subjects' brains when they were confronted with a counterclaim to a political and a non-political opinion. When a political belief was challenged, more of the brain lit up, including areas known as the default mode network and the amygdala. The former may be involved in identity, the latter in negative emotions. It's always difficult to interpret such studies. First, 40 subjects is a small number, and fMRIs involve a low signal-to-noise ratio. Assuming the results are valid, we also don't know exactly what they mean. Just because we can see one part of the brain light up, that doesn't mean we know what it's doing. The same structure in the brain will participate in different overlapping networks with different overlapping functions. It does seem clear, however, that the brain responds differently to political and non-political challenges in a way that is suggestive of an emotional response. The researchers also assessed the degree to which the subjects changed their minds on the facts that were challenged. They changed them more consistently for non-political than for political views. Again, there are lots of variables here. No one study is going to account for all of them, but it's an interesting start. This new study is consistent with prior research on the topic of motivated reasoning, and it points the way to further research. Follow-up studies with conservatives, with other ideologies, religious, social, historical, addressing other variables more directly, like how truthful or plausible the counterclaims are, and with larger numbers of subjects would all be helpful. These studies looking at the psychology and the neural correlates of motivated reasoning provide an essential insight into how the human brain behaves, and they reinforce how challenging it can be to be a consistent critical thinker. This suggests we should make a specific effort to be more detached when it comes to ideological beliefs. Factual beliefs about the world shouldn't be a source of identity, because those facts may be wrong, partly wrong, or incomplete. This is easier said than done. My strategy has been to focus my emotional investment on being skeptical. I take pride in being detached when it comes to factual claims, in following a valid process of logic and empiricism, and in changing my mind when necessary. I focus on the validity of the process, not on any particular claim or set of beliefs. In psychological terms, I try to follow the process of accuracy reasoning, not directional reasoning. This takes vigilance and practice, but it becomes more automatic over time. There is also a need to remind ourselves that people who disagree with us are just people. They are not demons. They have their reasons for believing what they do. They think they're right just as much as we think we are right. They don't disagree with us because we're virtuous and they are evil. They just have a different narrative than we do, one reinforced by a different set of facts and subjective judgments. This doesn't mean that all views are equally valid. It does suggest we should strive to focus on logic and evidence, not self-serving assumptions of moral superiority. Chapter 10. Skeptic's Guide Entry, Arguments and Logical Fallacies. A logical fallacy is an invalid connection between a premise and a conclusion, where the conclusion does not necessarily flow from the premise or premises, but is argued as if it does. I am convinced that the act of thinking logically cannot possibly be natural to the human mind. If it were, then mathematics would be everybody's easiest course at school, and our species would not have taken several millennia to figure out the scientific method. Neil deGrasse Tyson. The following is a comment I received on one of my blog posts on alternative medicine, in which I was criticizing the Mayo Clinic for promoting quackery. It is a fairly typical, even mild, example of the kinds of arguments I see on a daily basis. Clearly, the Mayo Clinic is run by a bunch of quacks and charlatans that have no interest in the health and well-being of the public. How dare they even consider something other than surgery or prescription medication to help people heal? More and more, I am getting the feeling that articles like this are by fronts for the pharmaceutical companies. This article is clearly written out of fear, fear that there are ideas and practices out there that you don't understand, and your only resort is to lash out against those ideas. In this case, you are attacking one of the most respected medical institutions in the world. Do you, Mr. Author, perhaps think that maybe you are the one that doesn't get it? How is it that people can disagree so vehemently, even about facts, not just subjective opinions? Often disagreements result simply from bad arguments, of which the above comment offers many examples, and we will explore them in detail below. The comment is not persuasive, because it is so poorly constructed. If the commenter was hoping to change my mind, they failed out of the gate because their arguments were fatally flawed. Among the core skills of critical thinking are the ability to formulate a coherent argument that uses valid logic, to police the validity of your own logic, and to recognize poor logic in the arguments of others. Arguments using logic that is not valid are considered logical fallacies. What is an argument? If you've ever spent any time engaging with other people, then you have likely been involved in an argument, perhaps even on a daily basis. Arguing is one of those things that everyone does but few understand. Yet arguing is an essential skill of critical thinking. How we argue reflects the way we think, the methods we use to evaluate our own conclusions, and how we challenge the beliefs of others. Even the very purpose of arguing is often misunderstood. I have arguments almost every day. This doesn't mean I verbally fight with others on a daily basis, but rather that I have discussions that involve either attempting to convince another of a specific conclusion or resolving different conclusions on a factual matter. In most of the arguments, the other person has staked out a position and they defend it jealously, as if they were a high-paid lawyer defending a client. But this adversarial approach isn't constructive. Rather, the parties of an argument should be trying to find common ground, and then proceed carefully from that common ground to resolve any differences. The first thing we should understand about a logical argument is that it follows a certain format. There are one or more premises, which are underlying facts that the argument takes for granted or is built upon. There is then some logical connection showing how these premises necessarily lead to a specific conclusion. Sometimes people will make an assertion as if it's an argument. An argument makes some connection between a premise and a conclusion. An assertion just states conclusions or premises without supporting them. So, for example, saying that my criticism of the Mayo Clinic was based on fear of new ideas was simply an assertion. The commenter offered nothing to support this conclusion. My original argument, however, was that the Mayo Clinic claims to be evidence-based to support only those treatments with adequate evidence that they work, and yet they promote acupuncture, which is not evidence-based. Those are my premises. Therefore, they are failing in their stated mission, my conclusion. See the difference? Here is another important thing to keep in mind. If the premises of an argument are true and sufficiently complete, and the logic is valid, in which case the argument is said to be, quote, sound, then the conclusion must be true. In order for the conclusion to be false, one or more premises must be false, or there are hidden or incomplete premises, or the logic is invalid. If homeopathic products contain nothing but water, and water cannot have any specific medical effects other than hydration, then homeopathy is not medicine. So, if an argument is sound, the conclusion is true. However, the converse is not true. An unsound argument can still have a conclusion that happens to be true, even though the argument doesn't support it. Someone might argue that the sun is a sphere because spheres are pretty. That isn't a sound argument, but the conclusion is still true. If two people have come to different conclusions about a factual claim, then one or both must be wrong. Both cannot be correct. One or both must therefore have made an error in the arguments they use to come to their conclusions. The two parties should work together to examine their arguments and resolve any errors. Keep in mind this only works if the arguments are about factual claims, not subjective feelings or value judgments. There is no objective way to resolve a difference of opinion regarding aesthetics, for example. If you prefer Mozart to Beethoven, there is no way to prove Mozart's superiority with facts or logic. It is very helpful, however, to identify when a conclusion contains an aesthetic opinion or a moral choice. It avoids arguing endlessly over an issue that is inherently irresolvable. First, turn your sights inward. All too often, I see people use knowledge of argument and logic to deconstruct the arguments of others. This can easily turn into an attempt to find some flaw in the arguments of those they perceive as being against them, and then declare victory. But a knowledge of argument and logic must first be used to examine one's own position. If someone disagrees with someone else, it is best that they first deconstruct their own position to make sure their premises are true. There are no hidden premises, and their logic is valid. They must be open to the possibility that they have incomplete or wrong information, or that they've made a mental error. Outside of certain venues, like debate club and perhaps the courtroom, where it is one's job to defend a certain position, what is really desired is to have a position that is valid and true. This requires transparently examining one's own arguments. In other words, logic and arguments should be used as a tool, not a weapon. When logic is used as a weapon, it's far too easy to twist it subtly to suit one's ends. It is, of course, also good to deconstruct the arguments of others. However, it is important to strive to be as fair as possible. This is called the principle of charity. Give the other the benefit of the doubt, take the best interpretation of their position possible, and deconstruct that. Again, the goal should not be to win. No one is keeping score. The goal of critical thinking and skepticism is to have the most valid position possible, and this means accounting for the best possible arguments that challenge our position. Examine your premises. As stated previously, in order for an argument to be sound, all of its premises must be true. Often, different people come to different conclusions because they're starting with different premises. So examining all the premises on both sides of an argument is a good place to start. There are four types of potential problems with premises. The first, and most obvious, is that a premise can be wrong. If one argues, for example, that evolutionary theory is false because there are no transitional fossils, that argument is unsound because the premise, no transitional fossils, is false. In fact, there are copious transitional fossils. Another type of premise error occurs when one or more premises are unwarranted assumptions. The premise may or may not be true, but it hasn't been established sufficiently to serve as a premise for an argument. Identifying all the assumptions upon which an argument is dependent is often the most critical step in analyzing the argument. Frequently, different conclusions are arrived at because of differing assumptions. Often people will choose the assumptions that best fit the conclusion they prefer. In fact, psychological experiments show that most people start with conclusions they desire, then reverse engineer arguments to support them, a process called rationalization. One way to resolve the problem of using assumptions as premises is to carefully identify and disclose those assumptions up front. Such arguments are often called hypothetical or are prefaced with the statement, Let's assume for the sake of argument. Also, if two people examine their arguments and realize they are using different assumptions as premises, then at least they can agree to disagree. They will realize that their disagreement cannot be resolved until more information is available to clarify which assumptions are more likely to be correct. For example, two people may disagree about whether or not the minimum wage should be increased because they are basing their conclusions on different starting assumptions. One person may assume that raising the minimum wage costs jobs, while another may assume that it doesn't. Until they resolve that difference, further arguments may be futile. The third type of premise difficulty is the most insidious, the hidden premise. Obviously, if a disagreement is based upon a hidden premise, then the disagreement will be irresolvable. So, when coming to an impasse in resolving differences, it's a good idea to go back and see if there are any implied premises that haven't been addressed. Let's go back to the transitional fossil example. Why is it that scientists believe we have many transitional fossils and evolution deniers, creationists or intelligent design proponents, believe we do not? This would seem to be a straightforward factual claim, easily resolvable by checking the evidence. Sometimes evolution deniers are simply ignorant of the evidence or are being intellectually dishonest. However, the more sophisticated ones are fully aware of the fossil evidence and use a hidden premise to deny the existence of transitional fossils. When paleontologists speak of, quote, transitional fossils, they are referring to species that occupy a space morphologically and temporally between two known species. This may be a common ancestor, in which case the transitional fossil will be more ancient than both descendant species, or it can be temporally between two species, the descendant of one and the ancestor of the other. But in reality, we often do not know if the transitional species is an actual ancestor, or just closely related to the true ancestor. Because evolution is a bushy process and not linear, most of the specimens we find will lie on an evolutionary side branch, an uncle rather than a parent. But if they fill a morphological gap in known species, they provide evidence of an evolutionary connection and therefore qualify as transitional. For example, Archaeopteryx may not be on the direct path to modern birds, but clearly it occupies a space that is transitional between theropod dinosaurs and modern birds, and one of its close relatives is a direct ancestor of modern birds. When evolution deniers say there are no transitional fossils, their unstated major premise is that they are employing a different definition of, quote, transitional than is generally accepted in the scientific community. They typically define transitional as some impossible monster with half-formed and useless structures, or they may define transitional as only those fossils for which there is independent proof of there being a true ancestor rather than simply closely related to a direct ancestor, an impossible standard. Another hidden premise in their argument is the notion of how many transitional fossils there should be in the fossil record. They, of course, can always assume an arbitrarily high number in order to claim that there aren't enough. The fourth potential problem with premises, one that could be very subtle, is when a premise contains a subjective judgment. You might take as a premise that a particular news source is reliable. It is reliable according to what criteria and whose judgment. Subjective evaluations too easily allow for tweaking the premises to fit the desired conclusion. Let's look again at the commenter's criticism. They felt as if articles criticizing the promotion of pseudoscience in medicine were just fronts for Big Pharma. This allows them to dismiss arguments they don't like. Their feeling is subjective. It is based on their pre-existing conclusion, which then becomes an assumed premise. In this way, subjective premises easily become circular reasoning. They are simply a filter through which we see the world in order to confirm what we already believe. Logical fallacies. Even when all the premises of an argument are reliably true, the argument may still be unsound if the logic employed is not valid, if there's a so-called logical fallacy. The human brain is a marvelous machine with capabilities that, in some ways, still outperform the most powerful of supercomputers. Our brains, however, do not appear to have evolved specifically for precise logic. There are many common logical pitfalls that our minds tend to fall into unless we are consciously aware of these pitfalls and make efforts to avoid them. Also, because there is a tendency to start with desired conclusions and then construct arguments to support them, many people will happily draw upon logical fallacies to make their arguments. In fact, every time someone tries to form an argument to support a conclusion that isn't true, they must either employ a false premise or a logical fallacy. Remember, a sound argument, one with true premises and valid logic, cannot lead to a false conclusion. So they have no choice but to use false premises or bad logic if they want to defend a false conclusion. In order to avoid using logical fallacies to construct unsound arguments, we need to understand how to identify fallacious logic. The following are the common logical fallacies, with examples of each, to help us all avoid bad arguments. I should note that these are all informal logical fallacies, which means that the logic is questionable, but its validity often depends upon context. They're not strictly invalid all the time. Formal logical fallacies are always invalid. For example, if I take the premises that A equals B and B equals C, and I conclude that A does not equal C, that is a formal logical fallacy. The conclusion is always wrong. Informal logical fallacies, as you will see with the examples, are more squishy. Non sequitur. From Latin, this term translates to "it doesn't follow," and it refers to an argument in which the conclusion does not necessarily follow from the premises. In other words, a logical connection is implied where none exists. This is the most basic type of logical fallacies, and in fact, all logical fallacies are non sequiturs. So, for example, if I said that Swiss cheese is healthy for you because it's yellow, that is a non sequitur because there is no logical connection between the premise and the conclusion. Argument from authority. The basic structure of such arguments is as follows. Professor X believes A. Professor X speaks from authority. Therefore, A is true. Often, this argument is implied by emphasizing the many years of experience of the individual making a specific claim or the number of formal degrees they hold. The converse of this argument is sometimes used too, that someone does not possess authority and therefore their claims must be false. This may also be considered an ad hominem logical fallacy, as I'll discuss later in this chapter. In practice, this can be a complex logical fallacy to deal with. It is legitimate to consider the training and experience of an individual when examining their assessment of a particular claim. Also, a consensus of scientific opinion does carry some legitimate authority. But it is still possible for highly educated individuals and a broad consensus to be wrong. Speaking from a position of authority does not make a claim necessarily true. Remember my previous commenter who appealed to the authority of the Mayo Clinic. They are a respected institution. Therefore, anything they support must be legitimate. That argument does not counter my specific criticisms of the clinic's behavior, however, in promoting a treatment not supported by evidence. This logical fallacy crops up in more subtle ways, too. For example, UFO proponents have argued that UFO sightings by airline pilots should be given special weight because pilots are trained observers, reliable characters, trained not to panic in emergencies. Oftentimes, the opinions of Nobel laureates are given great weight. This has historically led to, frankly, pseudoscientific positions taken up by such laureates later in their careers being taken seriously only because of the support of the laureate. The most notable example of this is Linus Pauling. Linus Pauling won two Nobel Prizes, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry in 1954 and the 1962 Nobel Peace Prize for his activism against nuclear weapons. Pauling was a brilliant researcher. Of that there is no doubt. But later in life, he descended into quackery, advocating for megadoses of vitamin C to fight off infections, including the common cold. This was part of his broader support for orthomolecular medicine, a term he coined. According to Pauling, substances that occur naturally in the body can be used to fight disease. This is the perfect example of a brilliant scientist stepping outside his area of expertise and applying the wrong principles to another discipline. The concept of orthomolecular medicine may make sense to a chemist who is focused on the chemical activity of biological substances, but medical researchers are likely to find such ideas hopelessly naive, even accounting for the time period. Pauling failed to support his ideas with clinical research and failed to recognize the need to translate a basic scientific understanding of things like biochemistry to actual clinical applications. Our understanding is advancing, but the body is ridiculously complex, and net clinical effects therefore need to be measured. We cannot simply extrapolate from our basic science knowledge to clinical claims, as Pauling did. Saying that orthomolecular medicine must be valid, because it was supported by a scientist of the stature of Pauling, would be an argument from authority logical fallacy. At the same time, saying that we should take very seriously the consensus of scientists who believe that life is the result of organic evolution would not be fallacious. That is a solid consensus, more than 98% of scientists, built upon a mountain of evidence, examined and argued for more than a century. Casually dismissing a solid scientific consensus as an argument from authority is a misuse of the logical fallacy. It is also an excellent example of how important context is in evaluating informal logical fallacies. This is a good time to bring up another aspect of informal logical fallacies, the lumper versus splitter debate. Do we lump similar types of logical fallacies into one broad category, or do we split them up and give each slight variation its own name? I tend to be a lumper myself. I think it is important to grasp the essence of a fallacy and see how it applies broadly. For example, there are many types of argument from authority. You can appeal to the authority of popular opinion, which may be called separately an argument ad populi. Or you could appeal to celebrity, or to the implied authority of the future, when your opinions will allegedly be validated. Anytime you rely on the source of an argument or position rather than facts and logic, that becomes an argument from authority. Argument from final outcome. Such arguments, also called teleological, are based on a reversal of cause and effect, because they argue that something is caused by the ultimate effect that it has or the purpose that it serves. Christian creationists have argued, for example, that evolution must be wrong, because if it were true, it would lead to immorality, also a false premise. Naive evolutionary thinking can also be teleological, for example, the argument that birds evolved feathers so that they could fly, when in fact, feathers likely had to evolve prior to flight, and bird ancestors did not know they would ultimately use feathers for flying. Evolution cannot look forward. Proto-feathers must have evolved for a purpose they served at the time, like insulation. Post hoc ergo propter hoc. This is perhaps the most common of logical fallacies. It follows the basic format of A preceded B, therefore A caused B, assuming cause and effect for two events just because they are temporally related. The Latin translates to after this, therefore because of this. This logical fallacy is frequently invoked when defending various forms of alternative medicine. I was sick, I took treatment A, I got better, therefore treatment A made me better. This is a logical fallacy because it's possible to have recovered from an illness without any treatment. Confusing correlation with causation. This is similar to the post hoc fallacy in that it assumes cause and effect for two variables simply because they occur together. This fallacy is often used to give a statistical correlation a causal interpretation. For example, during the 1990s, both religious attendance and illegal drug use were on the rise. It would be a fallacy to conclude that, therefore, religious attendance causes illegal drug use. It is also possible that drug use leads to an increase in religious attendance, or that both drug use and religious attendance are increased by a third variable, such as an increase in societal unrest. It is perfectly possible that both variables are independent of each other, and it is mere coincidence that they are both increasing at the same time. In essence, there are always four possible interpretations of any apparent correlation. The first is that the correlation is not causal at all. The second is that A causes B. The third is that B causes A. The fourth is that A and B are both caused by another variable, C. It's helpful to go through all such possibilities before concluding that any one causal pattern is true. This fallacy is often combined with data mining, looking at large sets of data for apparent correlation. People usually underestimate the number of correlations that are likely to occur by chance alone when data sets are sufficiently large. To illustrate this, there is a website made by Tyler Vigen called Spurious Correlations. You can enter a number of variables into databases linked to by this site, which will then display a graph showing how well they correlate. For example, U.S. spending on science, space, and technology between 1999 and 2009 tightly correlates with deaths by hanging, strangulation, and suffocation. There is also an excellent correlation between the number of people who drown by falling into a swimming pool and the number of movies in which Nicolas Cage appears. My favorite, however, is the tight correlation between organic food sales and autism diagnoses. Presumably, these are all chance correlations. This fallacy, confusing causation and correlation, has a tendency to be abused or applied inappropriately to deny all statistical evidence. In fact, this constitutes a logical fallacy in itself, the denial of causation. This abuse is captured in the oft-misquoted phrase, correlation does not imply causation. Well, in fact, it does imply causation, and may be due to a particular causation. Sometimes A does cause B. A better quote would be that correlation does not necessarily imply causation, or that it does not alone prove causation. But it is one line of evidence for it. To properly interpret the implication of an apparent correlation, we have to look at the evidence itself. If the correlation is part of an experiment in which all variables possible were controlled for, such as in a double-blind, placebo-controlled medical trial, then any correlation found is likely to be a real effect of treatment. If the treatment correlates with a better outcome and all placebo effects were controlled for, it is likely that this correlation does result from the causation of the treatment effecting a cure. Second, even with purely epidemiological or statistical evidence, it's still possible to build a strong scientific case for a specific cause and effect. The weakness of such observational data is that confounding factors are not controlled for, so there may be many causes of an apparent correlation. However, we can look at multiple independent correlations to see if they all point to the same causal relationship. We can triangulate to the most likely cause. For example, it was observed that cigarette smoking correlates with getting lung cancer. The tobacco industry, invoking the correlation is not causation logical fallacy, argued that this does not prove that smoking causes lung cancer. They offered as an alternate explanation factor X, a third variable that causes both the urge to smoke and lung cancer. But we can make predictions based upon the smoking causes cancer hypothesis. If true, then duration of smoking should correlate with cancer risk, quitting smoking should decrease cancer risk, and smoking unfiltered cigarettes should have a higher cancer risk than filtered cigarettes. If all of these correlations turn out to be true, which they are, then we can triangulate to the smoking causes cancer hypothesis as the most likely possible causal relationship explaining the correlation between smoking and lung cancer. Special pleading or ad hoc reasoning. This is a subtle fallacy, often difficult to recognize. In essence, it's the arbitrary introduction of new elements into an argument in order to jerry-rig that argument so it appears valid. A good example is the ad hoc, literally for this, dismissal of negative test results. For instance, one might argue that ESP has never been demonstrated under adequate test conditions, therefore ESP is not a genuine phenomenon. Defenders of ESP have attempted to counter this argument by introducing the arbitrary premise that ESP does not work in the presence of skeptics. Or, perhaps ESP starts and stops working as needed to explain random lucky streaks in the data. Or maybe ESP powers actually decline over time for some strange reason, which explains why ESP effects disappear when more rigorous scientific controls are put in place. Bigfoot supporters have argued that big feet are psychic, so they know when people are coming and hide. Or perhaps they can teleport, or turn invisible at will. No bodies have been found because they burn their dead or bury them in well-hidden locations. Carl Sagan gave perhaps the most famous example of this fallacy in his invisible, floating, incorporeal, heatless dragon in his garage argument. Essentially, he claims that there is a dragon in his garage and then invents a special reason why each test for the presence of the dragon fails. It's important to note that special pleading arguments are not fallacious because they're necessarily wrong. It is quite possible that an acupuncture study failed to show effectiveness beyond placebo because the wrong needles or improper techniques were used. Such arguments are unconvincing because they are invented as needed, without independent evidence to support them. People are generally clever and can always think of some "my dog ate my Bigfoot evidence" type excuse. Tu quoque. The Latin phrase tu quoque translates to "you too." This is an attempt to justify wrong action because someone else does the same thing. My evidence may be bad, but so is yours. This fallacy is frequently committed by proponents of various alternative medicine modalities who argue that even though their therapies may lack evidence of effectiveness, more mainstream modalities also lack such evidence. That argument, of course, doesn't justify a treatment that lacks evidence. It is, furthermore, a false premise, as the level of evidence for mainstream therapies is often much higher than for those considered, quote, alternative. Ad hominem. An ad hominem argument is one that attempts to counter another's claims or conclusions by attacking the person rather than by addressing the argument itself. True believers will often commit this fallacy by countering the arguments of skeptics with statements that skeptics are closed-minded. Skeptics may fall into the same trap, dismissing the claims of UFO believers, for instance, by stating that people who believe in UFOs are crazy or stupid. A common form of this fallacy is frequently present in the arguments of conspiracy theorists, who also rely heavily on ad hoc reasoning. For example, they may argue that the government must be lying because it's corrupt. The term poisoning the well refers to a form of ad hominem fallacy. This is an attempt to discredit the argument of another by implying that they possess an unsavory trait, or that they're affiliated with beliefs or people that are wrong or unpopular. A well-known form of this, which has its own name, Godwin's Law or the Reductio ad Hitlerum, refers to an attempt at poisoning the well by drawing an analogy between another's position and Hitler or the Nazis. Again, remember the commenter at the beginning of this chapter. They felt I was a shill, that I was writing out of fear, and that I just didn't get it. They never countered any of my actual evidence or logic. They just attacked my motivations and character. That is a classic ad hominem fallacy. It should be noted, however, that not all name-calling is a logical fallacy. If I impolitely state that someone with whom I disagree is a jackass, that's not an ad hominem logical fallacy. If I say their argument is wrong because they are a jackass, then that is a fallacy. But they still may be a jackass. Sidebar, closed-minded. Perhaps the most routine ad hominem fallacy directed at skeptics is the claim that we are closed-minded, which functions exactly like accusing someone of lacking faith or lacking vision. Using the charge of closed-mindedness to dismiss valid criticism is a fallacy, but it's also often an incorrect premise. Skepticism isn't closed-minded, and the opposite of skepticism is not open-mindedness. It's gullibility. Scientists, critical thinkers, and skeptics can and should be completely open-minded, which means being open to the evidence and logic, whatever it says. If the evidence supports a view, then we will accept that view in proportion to the evidence. But being open-minded also means being open to the possibility that a claim is wrong. It doesn't mean assuming every claim is true or refusing to ever conclude that something is simply false. If the evidence leads to the conclusion that a claim is false or a phenomenon does not exist, then a truly open-minded person accepts that conclusion in proportion to the evidence. Open-mindedness works both ways. Ironically, it's usually those accusing their critics of being closed-minded that tend to be the most closed. They are closed to the possibility that they are wrong. Ad ignorantiam. The argument from ignorance basically states that a specific belief is true because we don't know that it isn't true. Defenders of extrasensory perception, for example, will often overemphasize how much we don't know about the human brain. It's possible, they argue, that the brain may be capable of transmitting signals at a distance. UFO proponents are probably the most frequent committers of this fallacy. Almost all UFO eyewitness evidence is ultimately an argument from ignorance. Lights or objects sighted in the sky are unidentified, and therefore alien spacecraft. Intelligent design is almost entirely based upon this fallacy. The core argument for intelligent design is that there are biological structures that have not been fully explained by evolution. Therefore, a powerful, intelligent designer must have created them. In this context, arguments from ignorance are often referred to as, quote, God of the gaps arguments, because God is offered as the explanation for any current gap in our knowledge. Often, the argument from ignorance is defended with the adage, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. While this sounds pithy, it's not strictly true. Absence of evidence is, in fact, evidence of absence. It's just not absolute proof of absence. A more scientific way to look at this question is this. How predictive is the absence of evidence for the absence of the phenomenon in question? Well, that depends on how thoroughly we've looked and with what sensitivity. You can't ever prove a negative, but the more you look for something without finding it, the less likely it is to exist. We haven't found alien signals yet, but it's a big universe out there, and we have only surveyed a tiny slice. On the other hand, we have scoured Loch Ness for decades without any signs of Nessie. So I am not holding my breath that a giant creature is lurking beneath the waves. In any case, in order to make a positive claim, positive evidence for that specific claim must be presented. The absence of another explanation only means that we don't know. It doesn't mean we get to make up a specific explanation. Confusing currently unexplained with unexplainable. Because we don't currently have an adequate explanation for a phenomenon does not mean that it's forever unexplainable, or that it therefore defies the laws of nature or requires a paranormal explanation. This is often tied to the argument from ignorance, assuming that our current ignorance will never be filled in by knowledge. For example, it's often argued that we don't understand how the brain creates the phenomenon of consciousness. Therefore, the material causes of consciousness are unknowable and spiritual. Actually, neuroscience is progressing quite well, thank you, and we continue to deepen our knowledge of the brain. False continuum. A false continuum is the idea that because there is no definitive demarcation line between two extremes, the distinction between the extremes is therefore not real or meaningful. For example, there is a fuzzy line between cults and religion. Therefore, they are really the same thing. This is like saying that no one is short or tall, that the very concepts of shortness and tallness are invalid because there is no sharp dividing line between the two. However, extremes can exist and be meaningful and clearly recognized, even when there is a fuzzy border in the middle. This logical fallacy is often combined with the tu quoque logical fallacy. For instance, someone engaged in rank pseudoscience might argue that mainstream scientists sometimes break the rules too, by using small sample sizes, subjective outcomes, or similar bad methods. Therefore, there is no real difference between science and pseudoscience. This type of argument is closely related to another logical fallacy, the false equivalency. Extreme fraud doesn't become okay because everyone cheats a little. False dichotomy. This fallacy involves arbitrarily reducing a set of many possibilities to only two. For example, evolution isn't possible, so we must have been created, which assumes these are the only two possibilities. This fallacy can also be used to oversimplify a continuum of variation to two black and white choices. Science and pseudoscience are not two discrete entities, for instance. The methods and claims of all those who attempt to explain reality fall along a continuum from one extreme to the other. Reducing all factual claims to either pure science or pure pseudoscience would be creating a false dichotomy. False analogy. A false analogy or faulty analogy consists of assuming that because two or more things are similar in one way, then they are also similar in some other way, ignoring any important distinctions between the two. One might say that the protein complex that moves the flagellum of a bacterium is like a motor. Creationists then argue that this is evidence against evolution, because motors are designed, and therefore the flagellum must also have been designed. They are taking a metaphor that was intended to convey one meaning and extending it to another, turning a legitimate analogy into a false analogy. Flagella are like motors in that they have multiple moving parts that work together to create a specific motion. This is where the analogy ends, however. The flagellum is a biological motor, so it has a biological origin. Car motors are not biological. They are inanimate and therefore cannot evolve on their own. False analogy can be a very subtle logical fallacy. You must always ask the question, are the things being compared truly analogous? And even if they are analogous in some ways, are they analogous in the specific ways that are being claimed? I think that false analogies are common because they represent a basic function of the human brain. Our brains operate largely by pattern recognition, and we frequently try to understand the novel by comparison to the familiar. Such comparisons are extremely useful, as is seeing commonality among disparate phenomena in order to perceive an underlying pattern. The trouble is that we're too good at pattern recognition and may see patterns where they don't exist. This carries over into the tendency to make analogies where they don't truly exist either. There is a flip side to this fallacy, denying a legitimate analogy because the two things being compared are not the same in every way. A valid analogy means that two things are similar in an important way relevant to the argument at hand. It doesn't mean they are identical. In that case, they wouldn't be analogous. They would simply be the same thing. However, some try to dismiss a valid analogy by finding a trivial or irrelevant difference between the things being compared. I might argue that vaccines produce immunity to a disease in the same way that an infection does. An anti-vaccinationist might then counter that this is a false analogy, because infections occur naturally and vaccines are unnatural. This would be a false analogy argument, since the manner of exposure doesn't necessarily affect the response of the immune system. Genetic fallacy. The term genetic here doesn't refer to DNA or genes, but to origins. This fallacy consists of arguing against something because of where it came from, rather than considering whether or not it is valid in its current form. For example, one might argue that the company Volkswagen is not a good company because it was created by Hitler. However, the company was created in 1937, and its origins 80 years ago likely have no influence on how it behaves today. Similarly, the science of astronomy evolved out of astrology, but no one would seriously argue that astronomy is not a legitimate science because of its origins. Inconsistency. It's not valid to apply criteria or rules to one belief, claim, argument, or position, but not to others. Some consumer advocates argue that we need stronger regulation of prescription drugs to ensure their safety and effectiveness, but at the same time they argue that herbal drugs should be sold with no regulation for either safety or effectiveness. This fallacy often takes the form of using inconsistent definitions of terms. In order to have a coherent discussion or formulate a valid scientific hypothesis, all terms must be unambiguously defined. Switching around a vague definition as needed causes confusion, perhaps the exact kind of confusion intended. For example, some proponents of intelligent design use the term information inconsistently throughout their arguments. ID proponent William Dembski has tried to argue that evolution cannot create increased information in DNA without intelligent guidance. But he confuses mathematical information with philosophical meaning, semantic information. Mathematical information might describe the minimal bits of data necessary to fully describe something. A random and meaningless sequence actually takes more mathematical information to characterize because there are no patterns that can be summarized. Random mutation can therefore increase this type of information in DNA, even without any intelligent guidance. In his arguments, Dembski bounces back and forth between these types of, quote, information.